You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Cheng Li. I'm a senior fellow and the director of the John L. Saunton China Center here at the Brookings. And first, I want to join my colleague and mentor, Richard Bush, to welcome guests, guest speakers, especially from those who are from Taiwan, who travel all the way for this excellent conference. This morning's panel and also two keynote speakers really did a good job. I hope that we will reach their level and in our excellent panel. Earlier, someone mentioned, used a term, I think called linkage politics, talk about linkage, about China's domestic development or any country's domestic development with the United States, also Taiwan, and also its implication for their policies in the region. Now, certainly we know that China's economic and political development, which is the main theme, main topic for this panel, will have very strong implications to cross-strait relations. But currently, that economic and political situation or development in China is a very complicated one. It is very important for United States, for many other regions, to have a solid understanding or balanced view of China's domestic development, whether political or socioeconomic. If our view is non-balanced or imbalanced or distorted, our policy will be too. But China's political economic development, in my view, is very paradoxical. We can see from China's political front, Xi Jinping started a very strong and bold anti-corruption, which has been well received in China. He got the public support. His popularity has been very high. Also, that more than any other leader in China's modern history, Xi Jinping talked about legal China. Legal development of China will become one of his major legacies. And also, more than any other leaders in China's PRC history, he emphasized the role of think tanks, especially think tanks' discourse about China's domestic and international policies. But these are very positive developments. But look at the concerns. The concerns include people say that anti-corruption become too excessive or really receive very strong opposition. And also that when Xi Jinping talk about legal reform, legal development, or legal China, that in reality, you also see the anti-corruption is really not based on rule of law. And also, like national security laws and foreign NGO laws really create an atmosphere very worrisome, and international community responded very, very negatively. And earlier we heard our reporters talk about the arrest of the human rights lawyers, whether it be 50s or over 100, we do not know, but certainly that's a clear kind of a policy measure and from the establishment. But on the economic front, also you see the paradox. On the one hand, Xi Jinping, especially under the so-called third platinum, really accelerated the financial liberalization and market reform, and including free trade zones, private sector development, and also the private banks now start to play a very, very important role. They provide loans for small and medium-sized companies, especially recent college graduates now could receive some loans from various banks and to do so-called innovation-driven kind of experiments. These are very promising. And also service sector, with education, public health, logistics, and et cetera, really also have a high percentage of growth rate. And finally, the AIIB really show that China's economic strength on global stage and China's influence, whether it be South America, Africa, or along the China's border, and become stronger and stronger in the economic development. But at the same time, we also see some fears or worry, the recent example of the stock market crisis. This is a term Chinese use, certainly give a sense of a humble, you know, feeling among Chinese. It reveals the vulnerability of China's economy. And also government interference still very, very strong, especially in the IT industry, that anti-monopoly law hurt the interests of foreign companies. And the private firms still in a less favorable position to compete in some ways. The land reform, I think one of the speakers will talk about, still in the very early stage, and China's urbanization process also to a certain extent delayed because of all these difficulties. And finally, there's a linkage between domestic economic development and political development. If we really want to have an innovation-driven economy, you should maintain a certain degree of political openness, which is lacking at the moment. So all these are challenges. These, I think that I hope that our panel, really four excellent speakers from various angles, based on their expertise, will shed light about their understanding of China's political and economic landscape and how to reconcile these paradoxes. So each speaker will speak for 12 minutes, and we have a timer. And then we will open for questions. I may start with one or two questions. Thank you very much. Please, Doctor. And since they already have their bios printed in the program, I don't want to talk about their achievements, their publication. Just mention that start with Dr. Lin, and please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that all right? Okay. Let me first express my appreciation to the host institutions, Brookings Institutions and Association for Formulations for inviting me to this wonderful conference. But since domestic politics is such a big issue, today I'm going to focus only on the culture aspect or cultural policy aspect. To my understanding, it is a very typical combination about political calculations and some market impacts in mainland China. So I will argue that culture is kind of a very important basis for the legitimacy of the PRC regime, but at the same time, it serves as a very useful toolkit to embrace many different aspects of the social life. So it's more like an instrumentalism to socialize the region and to promote some kind of market mechanism under the banner of culture industry, of culture leadership. But at the same time, I will argue, as the chairman indicated, that the importance of the role played by Xi Jinping himself, he pushed for the new thinking or new consolidation of power. So it is related to some kind of a political consolidation of the political leadership. So for instance, I think because of the time constraint, we are not going to go into the details about that. But you can think about the legitimacy of the CCP regime tracing back to the Yan'an period. If you reread Chairman Mao Zedong's Yan'an talks, so it's more like a reflection of the current leadership style under Xi Jinping, and also the desire to strike a balance about economic development and the new ethics or morality under new socialism or any kind of capitalism. So another important task is to redefine the so-called ideology. What is the current ideology? How to re-explain the current ideology? So as you can see that about 2 years ago, is a so-called number 9 documents to set up some prohibitions in the social life. For instance, to talk about the Western constitutional politics and the universal value or civil society and so forth. And also, there another interesting development about 1.5 years ago about Xi Jinping's talks to try to reflect on Mao Zedong's Yan'an talks. For instance, to re-emphasize that the social and the people's interests as the root of the culture in terms of arts and literature, and also to raise the flags of the socialist core values. And also, literature and arts are not just slaves of the market forces. They need to lead the market forces and to lead the country. So patriotism is the focus to lead correct historical, ethical, and national foundations. And also there are different opinions or even attacks about Western culture. So Western culture should be only the instrument, but main body. So it's a very interesting talk to remind us about the foundation of CCP's legitimacy, and also even trace back to the Qing dynasty about the instrumentalism of the Western value. So that is a very interesting a shift of the cultural policy, or we can see the refocusing on the impacts or the instrumentalism of culture in the political life. But at the same time, culture can be also utilized as a very important instrument to promote market impacts or market forces. For instance, there's similar documents about 2 years ago indicating that China has to establish supervision mechanism instead of direct management of the culture industries, and also to grasp the market mechanism by transferring administrative units into culture enterprises. And also, in the global setting, China should expand the global cultural exchanges and to enhance institutional capacity to consolidate the global voice power to describe a much better China story. So it is not just for domestic importation and also for the global implementation. But given the fact that China is such a big country, if we talk about the cultural change or cultural policy, I think we have to consider not just the central level, but also the local level. So according to our researches in the past few years, we noticed that the implementation at the local level will be different. In many cases, that will be a very interesting combination of real estate manipulation, market forces, and some political indoctrination. So there's a differences in different local tradition, and also there's some urban redevelopment schemes and some bureaucratic imagination about globalization, like global cities, for instance. So there's a different mindsets between the central and the local level. In some aspects, they even have some conflicts between the incentives of the local level and the policy guideline from the top. So if we put that, the local cultural implementation as a very important political economy in China, I will argue that we have to embrace or combine different aspects about urban development or rebuild the new township schemes. For instance, as I indicated earlier, that there's an imagination of a global city to push for globalization, and also a lot of urban reconstructions which will introduce a lot of new players. For instance, how to balance historical preservation and some market revenues. Because in many cases, these are not preservation cases. It's a real estate cases. And also there are a lot of connections with urban milieu with which they are embedded. And also there are different policy schemes to build, whether to build new clusters like high-tech zones or any kind of promoting a mature urban culture to promote innovation, which is a very important part for China's foreseeable future in terms of manufacturing 4.2 or any kind of advancement. To wrap up some of the different aspects about local culture policy and the central policies, actually, there are domestic and the global aspects about this cultural dimension, but at the same time, it may also intensify the differences between the state and society. Probably not the conflicts between the state and society. The state tried to incorporate the society into their comprehensive scheme of governance. And also, we also notice the emergence of the so-called strategic business alliances between the local governments and many private sectors. The local government have transformed themselves as a very important market machine, or under the different banners or labels of development companies. And also, at the same time, given all these market impacts, I will argue that culture is still a very sensitive sphere of influences in mainland China. There are a lot of political topics like local identity, the tolerance of local identity, and also even tracing back to the golden era of the Mingguo era in 1920s or 30s. This is also a very sensitive issue. And also whether China will promote a real human-based cultural development or institutional and market-based of cultural development. That was still under debate, and we can have some more elaboration in the future. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Professor Lin. First of all, following the timeline, and also really address a very important the topic about culture. As we know that the Xi Jinping also emphasized the culture development, the so-called soft power, so-called Chinese dream, and also rejuvenation of the Chinese nation all reflect his old culture approach. But at the same time, you know, he talk about the Confucianism is important for China's development. But at the same time, as you mentioned earlier, there's kind of a Maoism or cultural revolution style polity, sounds like also written in a certain way. So how to reconcile that one is also a challenge for foreign observers like ourselves. Now let's move to, I hope that in the Q&A you will shed light. Now next, Professor Hans Tong, and from Taiwan, National Taiwan University.
So you'll use the lectern.
Please.
Thank you, Dr. Li. Thanks a lot to the Brookings Institution and AFR for the invitation. This panel is a great opportunity for exchanging views with seasoned China watchers on what has been going on in China after Xi Jinping took power and some potential policy implications. I'm going to be using China instead of mainland China, since there is no confusion in this panel anyway. So while most people today might be more interested in knowing things about China's stock market plunge and how this episode is going to end, I suppose it's equally important to take a bit longer term view on what Xi has brought to China's political regime since 2012. So what I'm going to offer today in my roughly 12-minute talk is a tentative explanation based on the recent burgeoning literature on authoritarianism, authoritarian institution in the fields of comparative politics and political economy, along with my own contribution to it. So the first half of Xi Jinping's first term since 2012 has dazzled many seasoned observers of the Chinese politics. So there were open trials of prominent political figures such as Bo Xilai and more recently Zhou Yongkang, who used to be worshipped in China's political pantheon, the Politburo. And there was also an anti-corruption campaign sweeping across both upper and lower echelon within the Chinese bureaucracy. Furthermore, there were new social initiatives launched to engage newly emerging opinion leaders and to help tighten up the government's control over the society as a recent regulation for setting up leading party members group in social organizations shows. These new developments defy some conventional wisdom in China, in the China field. Was it all because of, as some suggested, the leadership style of Xi Jinping that such a great transformation in Chinese politics could happen? Or was there any more systematic or institutional factor that could account for all these? So now I will return to the theory of authoritarian institutions for a while. Just to summarize the major points in this literature, first of all, the literature took its origin from political scientists wondering about why there are seemingly democratic institutions in authoritarian countries, and China, for one, has institutions such as political parties, People's Congress, and political consultative conference. The general conclusion from this literature is that since no dictators rule alone, they need to share power with other political elites and reward their supporters in order to secure their cooperation. As a consequence, having those seemingly democratic institutions can facilitate these political exchanges by making them more credible. This is one of the most important sources for authoritarian resilience. Moreover, on top of these insights from the literature, I make an argument here that we should actually further make a distinction between two kinds of authoritarian institutions. One established for power sharing with elites, while the other one for the co-optation of potential social opposition. The main justification here is that these two different kinds of institutions are actually designed to deal with different regime risks. The former is defined as the sharing of the spoils from joint rule between the dictator and his allies and geared towards avoiding coups, while the latter defined as a kind of political exchange where the dictator rewards his supporters is for avoiding revolutions. More critically, given the fact that the dictator's resources are limited in their institutional investment, and therefore investing more in the power-sharing institutions implies investing less in the co-optation institutions. So given this conceptual framework, we therefore could characterize different authoritarian regimes according to their investment profiles. Comparatively speaking, given the same level of regime risk, a single party authoritarian regime invests more in power sharing institutions, in power sharing with elites, and less in social cooptation than a personalist authoritarian regime where power is mainly concentrated in its autocrat. In addition to making comparisons across different regimes, the framework also allows us to make comparison over time. So now coming back to the Chinese case. So according to this framework, the Chinese regime under Xi's predecessor, Hu Jintao, obviously himself being a weak leader among elites, was apparently one that spent most of its resources in power-sharing institutions. This is why China before Xi had been described as a regime with a collective leadership or fragmented authoritarianism. However, Xi Jinping's regime has challenged this conventional wisdom. His transformation of China's political regime goes beyond just changing the rules. His transformation of China's political regime goes beyond just changing the rules again among Chinese political elites, but extends to its state-society relationship. This has created a whole new institutional landscape in the Chinese politics. And how should we characterize China's political regime under Xi Jinping? First of all, I mean, it only took several months for people to realize that China's collective leadership had almost come to an end. And it was now Emperor Xi who played solo. Especially after two important new organizations, one is Central National Security Council of the CPC and Chinese Communist Party, and the other one is the Central Leading Group for Comprehensive Deepening Reforms. After both organizations were established during the third plenary session of the 18th CPC Central Committee, most of China watchers realized that the current premier, Li Keqiang, had been sidelined, and it was primarily Xi who called the shots in most of important decisions regarding either national security or domestic reforms. At the same time, when Xi tried to consolidate his power through creating the two organizations I just mentioned, he also launched an anti-corruption campaign that has made both prominent CPC leaders and ordinary cadres arrested and tried. Xi's political move to purge several factional leaders and their henchmen implies strongly that he no longer wants to share power with other factions, as Hu Jintao used to do. Furthermore, the very fact that the anti-corruption campaign so far has gone beyond the level of top elites means that the campaign is not just about personal or power struggle, but it's also about making profound and systematic changes in China's power sharing arrangements. While, I mean, we don't have to go so far as to announce the death of the collective leadership, and Xi obviously need, and Xi needs no support from other prominent elites within the party, it is nevertheless undeniable that the rule of the game among elites since Jiang Zemin has been fundamentally changed. And Xi Jinping's bold moves in both the anti-corruption campaign and the restructuring of the top decision-making mechanisms can be explained as a response to increasing risks of social instability. As a matter of fact, addressing issues of social instability arising from a growing gap between rich and poor and tensions between corrupt officials and ordinary citizens was already a top priority during the Hu years. The Harmonious Society campaign under the Hu Wen administration was precisely designed to rein inequality across both social classes and regions. However, even if it seems that both Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao were fully aware about how social disparities could undermine the legitimacy of the communist rule in China, both of them and the entire leadership back then had never come up with any measures as radical as what Xi Jinping has done. As the son of one of the founding fathers of the People's Republic of China, Xi Jinping enjoys a substantially larger support base among the elites than his predecessor. This has enabled him to ignore various vested interests responsible for China's growing social tensions and adopt policy measures that could help diffuse potential dangerous risks, potential regime risks arising from intensifying social grievances. So if the political logic of regime survival posited above is right, and Xi does have the political capital to transform the Chinese regime, what exactly has he done so far to square up to challenges in this regard? And it was not until earlier this year did we begin to observe Xi's move in this social arena. So on May 29th, the Politburo passed a new new regulation, the regulation on CCP party, a leading party members group, that aims, on the one hand, further regulate and fortify the leading party members groups, in Chinese called Dangzu, that have already been established in non-party organizations such as the government agencies and quasi-government associations, and expand the party's outreach to social organizations such as NGOs that have been left out or left relatively untended by the CPC on the other. While the new regulation was announced to be only provisional, it soon gave rise to a wide concern among NGOs over being further squeezed politically owing to the party's organizational penetration if the law were to fully implemented. Technically, however, it probably takes some grand social engineering and mobilization to create pangos and party organization, party organized and non-governmental organization by setting up leading party members group in NGOs. This is because most NGO members are not party members, and it's even more unlikely to have party members assume leadership positions in them. Is Xi going to ask current NGO leaders to join the Communist Party, or is he going to take over NGOs by dispatching party members to be their leaders? it waits to be seen which approach Xi is going to take, or if this regulation is going to be a tiger without teeth. Regardless, this new policy endorsed by the Politburo, however, heralded a diversion of institutional investment from the power-sharing to co-optation institutions and an attempt to co-opt the potential opposition in the society. So combining both analyses on Xi's restructuring of China's elite politics and the new initiative in social co-optation completes my depiction of the institutional trajectory Xi Jinping's political maneuvering has taken. Facing a similar challenge arising from social tensions since China opened to the global economy, as Hu Jintao, Xi was able to react to the challenge in a totally different way because of the political clout his personal background endowed him with. However, the way in which Xi Jinping utilized this political endowment has followed a certain institutional logic. First of all, because power sharing and co-opting institutions are substitutes, she had to restructure the elite politics first before he could tackle the problems in social co-optation. Second, as far as social co-optation is concerned, she has adopted a party-based approach, since this is more effective than purely transfer-based one. Third, as institutional logic shows, when power sharing and co-opting institutions are substitutes, it is inevitable for Xi to break the previous pact between the dictator and his allies so he can have more leeway and resources for social co-optation. So finally, two takeaway points. So this is a big gamble she's taking right now. If she makes it and gains a broader support from support base from the society owing to the social co-optation, he will be able to create a new leadership model for China. If he fails during the term, then we shouldn't be surprised to see a Hu Jintao Jr. in charge in 2017. Second, so some policy implications for the neck of the woods where some of us are based. So Xi's great social and political engineering is almost certain to drive a wedge between the mainland and Hong Kong as well as Taiwan in many dimensions. Politically, people in Hong Kong and Taiwan, the younger generation especially, are going to find it more difficult to feel positively about mainland's political system. Socially, the shrinking space for the civil society in the mainland is also going to make it harder for the Chinese people outside of the mainland to appreciate the China dream. Thank you.
Wow, quite provocative. Okay, let's move to Scott Kennedy and CSIS.
Thank you, Chung. CSIS is proud to partner with the Brookings Institution and the Association of Foreign Relations on today's events, and we are really honored that so many people came to participate and from such a long way. I wanted to say, talk a little bit about three broad trends in China, and then what they mean for others in general, and then what they mean specifically for Taiwan. There's going to be a little bit of overlap in our remarks, particularly with Hans, but I think a slight different twist. And that's always fun. So the first, in China's policy process, I would agree with what Hans has said, is that power has moved up the system and into the party. There are now, in addition to the two organizations that he mentioned, there are actually 38 leading small groups now. They've doubled in number in just 2 years. And China has gone from fragmented authoritarianism to just straight authoritarianism. And I would just say this is not only that this is because of Xi Jinping's reading of the faults of the system before, that collective leadership or a fragmented approach meant that there was compromise in addressing every type of problem that the country faced, generated a lot of corruption, and limited China's ability to have global influence. And the solution to that was to centralize power and move it up and into the party. As a result, we have a much less transparent system. It's much harder to find out what's going on, even if you work in the system. And it means that it's subject to much more volatility at the top because it's just a small group of people making decisions. I like to say that Xi Jinping has a kitchen cabinet, a kitchen with several tables at it, and he goes from one table to another depending on which issue he's dealing with. And it's really just a small handful of people at each table, and there's just a couple people that move around with him to these different tables. That's a very different policymaking process than we've had in a very, very long time. In terms of economic policy, China's overriding goal is definitely about avoiding the middle income trap and moving up the value added chain in all spheres of production. In the process of doing that, they know they need to liberalize, and Xi Jinping has outlined a lot of reform efforts, but they need to find a balance with maintaining growth, which requires a whole variety of stimuli. And we saw that on full display last week, from a week ago Friday through last Friday. They threw everything at the stock market, including the kitchen sink. And today, I think at the end of trading on Monday, the Shanghai index is up about 13% over where it was at the end of trading on Wednesday. So apparently successful, but what that does is it makes it harder to implement the whole variety of reforms that they want to in order to move up the value-added chain. All of that translates, regardless of whether it's about reform or moving up the value-added chain, into a lot more investment abroad from China, a lot more trade. And you see Li Keqiang's visits. He's traveling the globe promoting manufacturing cooperation. Was in Latin America in early June, just was in the OECD, at the OECD headquarters about 10 days ago. And this is all fits with their economic reform goals. The third trend has to do with China and global governance. You know, there's a lot of talk about China trying to set up what people call a separate kitchen or a whole new international order. That's really not true. 99% of Chinese efforts are about integrating into existing international institutions, and they spend most of their time doing that on a day-to-day basis. Yet, since Xi Jinping came to power, they have developed some new organizations like the AIIB and try to increase their influence in existing institutions like the IMF and others. But these efforts really aren't because they are so dissatisfied with the existing rules. They just want more influence, or what they say, Hua Yu Quan. They want more voice. They don't know what they'll say when they get that voice, but they want a lot more voice. Now, these trends in politics, economic policy, and global governance have big implications for everyone that interacts with China. In terms of the policy process, it's just much more hard to follow this place. And it means that we all have to, whether we like it or not, engage the party directly. You cannot just go to ministries in China and find out what's going on anymore. You really need to go to party organizations in these leading groups. And that's not easy to do because the party doesn't really put out a sign and have a practice of welcoming people in for that type of engagement. In economic policy, it's clear now that even though this is a reformist leadership in general, the problems of economic reform, just the real problems of the economy day to day, mean that they are never going to end up in a pure market economy with this group in power. It's just not in their DNA, and they are never going to get to the other side of the shore. If you think of how they talk about feeling the stones across the river, that shore is super far away. It's like wider than Lake Michigan, so you can't ever see the other side. And as a result, also their goal, this means that as they move up the value-added chain, they're going to be competing more with advanced industrialized economies like the United States, like in Europe, like elsewhere in East Asia. And so as there's going to be greater business opportunities with China because average wages are rising rapidly, it means there's going to be more competition. And you're only going to be able to do well in China by targeting consumers and figuring out how to plug in and collaborate with the Chinese economic machine. And in terms of global governance, to paraphrase Zhou Nai, if you treat China as a system opponent, they will become a system opponent. So what we need to do is figure out incentives to get China to want to be in the international system. Otherwise, they will look for other things to do. So that's not guaranteed. It's really how we respond diplomatically. In terms of the implications for Taiwan, in terms of the policy process, it's about dealing with the Communist Party directly. For Taiwan, actually, that's probably easier than for any other country or region on the planet because there are already extensive direct party-to-party ties. So we just have to keep continuing that, and everyone actually needs to come to Taiwan and say, how do you guys do that? Because we need to learn how to do that as well. In terms of economic policy, it means that mainland China's economic gravity is going to continue to expand, and it's continue to draw Taiwan in. Regardless of which presidential candidate wins, regardless of their policies, diversifying Taiwan's international economic profile is going to be very, very difficult just because of that gravity in China's economic policies. It also means more economic opportunities like everyone else faces, but also particularly for Taiwan, a lot of competition. If you're in the semiconductor industry in Taiwan, you're facing a lot of challenges in China because that is the primary sector, one of the primary sectors where they are investing billions of dollars and forcing lots of collaborations right in the space where Taiwan has developed its core expertise. In terms of global governance, it's going to be more difficult for Taiwan to expand its international space. And it's going to face the challenge, like every other smaller country or territory in the region, of being forced again and again, perhaps, to have to choose between the United States and China every time there's some problem, like with AIIB. And it's in Taiwan's interests, and actually the United States and China's interests too, that we avoid those type of AIIB-like moments where there's this forcing of a choice. There's a lot of areas we're going to see that down the road. I'll just conclude by mentioning what's going to be the most obvious is on TPP. Taiwan is obviously hugely interested in being first in line once TPP is concluded and the new round of members can sign up. So is China, so is everybody else. Will we be able to follow a WTO-like formula for both sides getting in? That's going to be really hard because China has more power than it had in 2000 or in the late 90s when they made that deal with the United States that it'd be fine for Chinese Taipei to enter as long as China got in first. That's going to be a rougher going. But I think in this instance, it's the most important thing for Taiwan is that TPP be signed and it be implemented. And that is actually more important than Taiwan becoming a member, or when Taiwan becomes a member, because TPP is the leverage that the international system needs to push Chinese economic reform more broadly, to create more opportunities for businesses around the world and in Taiwan, and to get China to play by the rules that we think are appropriate, which will create more opportunities for Taiwan. So I think more attention to TPP in general, as opposed to which party becomes a member. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Very comprehensive point. Now, last but not least, and Professor Zheng Jing from Florida International University.
Hello, good afternoon. First, I want to thank our host for inviting me to this important conference. And I'm a PowerPoint person, so we will see if my talk today will become a lullaby without PowerPoint. I came back from China 4 days ago, and I would like to share with you some of my initial findings from my fieldwork on China's recent land reform. The rural land system has been central not only to farmers' welfare and rural development, but also to food security and social stability. This is especially true in China, a country that feeds 22% of the world's population with only 7% of the planet's arable land. In a span of less than 70 years, China's ruler land system has swung from privatization to collectivization and to something in between, the household responsibility system, which features collective ownership of ruler land with land use rights allocated among farmers in an egalitarian fashion. Given China's labor abundant and land scarce reality, each farmer was assigned only a tiny plot of land. Most farmers toiled on the land all year long, but with barely enough to get by. As China becomes urbanized and industrialized, over 250 million farmers have left the land and moved to cities. Only the old stayed behind to take care of the land. Since the early 2000s, the Chinese leadership have been facing the three serious ruler problems. Farmers are poor, the countryside is underdeveloped, and food production is precarious. In an effort to modernize agricultural production and alleviate ruler poverty, the Chinese government has taken unprecedented measures to empower farmers, including extending land use tenure, abolishing agriculture tax, and providing farmers with subsidies. In recent years, the Chinese government is vigorously promoting the transfer of ruler land use rights and the establishment of ruler land markets. By consolidating ruler land holdings, the reform aims to solve the problem of land fragmentation and enhance production efficiency. The sanction from the center has ushered in a wave of land use rights transfers. In the summer of 2014 and 2015, I conducted preliminary fieldwork in 10 Chinese villages, 2 in the northern province Shandong and 8 in the southeastern province Fujian. Despite the differences in the patterns of land transfers, some generalizations can be made. I would like to briefly first discuss three major opportunities of the reform. First, the recent land reform has enabled the emergence of new farming entities, including farms, farmers' cooperatives, and agriculture enterprises. Large-scale farming has created higher incentives for operators to modernize agricultural production and increase production efficiency. Second, the recent reform also attracted outside investors to rural areas. They bring the much-needed capital, technology, and management skills to rural areas, as well as creating job opportunities. Third, the recent land reform boosted income for some farmers. For those who lease the land from other villages, farming on a large contiguous parcel of land is more profitable. Despite progresses, difficulties remain. There are four major challenges of the recent land reform. First and foremost, frequent land adjustment poses as a serious barrier to long-term land transfer. To push forward ruler land reform, a prerequisite should be the stabilization of farmers' land tenure for years, if not for decades. Yet this runs counter to the ingrained principle of equality in land holdings at the village level. Among the 9 of 10 villages I interviewed, it's a common practice for villages to redistribute land among ruler households every 3 to 5 years, according to population changes. Even though the Chinese central government has extended land tenure from 15 to 30 years in 1993 and prohibited land readjustment during the contracted period, most farmers I interviewed expressed a strong preference for the configuration of land holdings to be readjusted every 3 to 5 years. Because of the short-term nature of land tenure, individual farmers could not lease out the land use rights for long-term. Investors interested in leasing land for a relatively long-term has to resort to the help of local governments, which created ample opportunities for rent-seeking. Second, and relatedly, the lack of a formal land registration program makes it difficult for large-scale land transfer. Most farmers I talked to do not have a land use rights certificate. Rather, the security of the property rights hinges on the common understanding and memories of fellow villagers. Frequent land redistribution also made land certificates redundant. Yet, the lack of a formal land registration program and land certificates could turn away outside investors or lead to land disputes when a lease involves outsiders. To correct the deficiency, China started the land registration program in 2008 and is rolling out the scheme nationwide this year. The goal is to complete land registration and the issuance of land use rights certificates to every rural household by 2020. The reform aims to further protect the land use rights of farmers and pave the way for large-scale land transfers. This sounds very good, right? However, the implementation of this well-intentioned policy encountered resistance at the village level, as farmers wanted to stick to the old practice of land readjustment. So shall local officials follow the mandates from Beijing or respect farmers' preferences? The answer seems to be both. For instance, in a county in Fujian province, officials from the county level down to the village level knew pretty well that farmers would have the final say on the duration of land tenure and that land use rights certificates are likely to be useless. Nevertheless, under the pressure from the superiors, local officials gradually complied with the new mandate and attempted to get the job done by 2017, the deadline set by the provincial government. The price tag of surveilling every piece of farming land and issuing land use certificate in the county is about 30 million RMB, a significant amount of the capital that could be put into productive use in other ways. Third, there has been no unified rural land market to facilitate land transactions. Instead, rural land transfers exhibit distinct features of dualism. On the one hand, most land transfers were among farmers in the same village on a voluntary basis. Such transfers were often informal, small-scale, short-term, and with lower rents. On the other hand, when agribusiness or outside investors wanted to lease land from farmers, they tended to rely on local officials to mediate deals with villagers. Such transfers are often large-scale, long-term, and with formal written contracts and higher rents. Although rural land transfer centers have been established at the township level in response to Beijing's mandates, few were functioning. Why? It's largely because most of these centers are short of staff, capital, and other resources. One township official confided to me that rural land transfers was at the bottom of his agenda. He was concurrently wearing two titles, the director of a rural land transfer center and the head of rural economic management office. And his office was simply too busy with other job assignments. After all, his performance is not evaluated against the progress of rural land transfer. According to him, his superiors only paid lip services to the importance of promoting rural land consolidation, but allocated no financial or human resources to his center for land transfers. Fourth, although the central government reiterated the importance of food security, there is a certain degree of diversion of land from food production to cash crops and non-farming uses. For instance, one agribusiness I interviewed leased 700 mu farming land from one village in Shandong province to cultivate quality cotton seeds. Another big agribusiness I interviewed rented land from various villages in Fujian province and turned arable land into chicken farms. Some farmers also lease the land to grow cash crops, such as tobacco, flowers, and herbs. Even though China has set a red line guarantee that arable land never shrinks to less than 1.8 million mu, or 120 million hectares, local officials I interviewed hardly follow the guideline in a strict manner. So what does China's land reform tell us? The Chinese government has repeatedly pledged to deepen rural reforms and step up agriculture modernization. Yet agriculture is still the weakest among the four pursuits of industrialization, informatization, urbanization, and agriculture modernization. Tackling problems in the countryside is crucial to China's efforts to build a moderately prosperous society, a key component of the Chinese dream proposed by Xi Jinping. The importance of rural development in China cannot be overstated. As a government statement said, if China wants to be strong, agriculture must be strong. If China wants to be beautiful, the countryside must be beautiful. If China wants to get rich, the farmers must get rich. Whether recent land reform helped to modernize China's agricultural production and get a Chinese farm rich, despite great fanfare, there are obvious problems in the design and implementation of the reform measures. China's recent move to encourage farmers to transfer the use rights of the contracted land has been driven first and foremost by the top leadership. The top-down reform approach assumes that reformers in Beijing have good knowledge of local conditions and the preferences of local participants. Yet, the government's efforts to secure land rights for farmers appear to be unpopular. Why? It seems that China's reformers follow the logic of economic efficiency, which contradicts the logic of social justice that prevails in most Chinese villages. Whether or not the recent land reform will be successfully carried out across China remains to be seen. But given China's huge size and great diversity, it will be judicious for policymakers to discard the one-size-fits-all fantasy by allowing more local discretion and flexibility when implementing reform policies. Last, I want to mention that the mainland China and Taiwan are facing similar problems of small-scale farming, the aging farming population, and the lack of competitiveness in the agriculture sector. In May 2009, the Council of Agriculture of Taiwan launched the Small Landlords, Big Tenants policy. So the governments of the two sides of the Taiwan Strait can certainly learn from each other about the design and implementation of the reform measures to solve a common set of problems. Thank you.
Well, four excellent presentations. And before open the door for questions, let me have a round of questions for my colleagues in the panel. First one is for Dr. Lin, but also for others. Xi Jinping recently announced his blueprint, his ideological framework, which can interpret in four areas he called four comprehensiveness, namely middle-class development, market economy, rule of law, and the governance in terms of the tough measures against party corruption and also in terms of party governance, etc. Now, in your view, this is a good framework or bad framework? Or that you can also interpret this the empty promises, hypocrisy. It's a huge mismatch. Or alternatively, we may argue that all these things need time. This is still in the process. And in many other countries, all this development takes a long time. So we should be patient. This is still a good framework. So this is where, since you talk about the culture, talk about ideologies, it's the overall framework. So this is a question for you. Let me finish the question for other three as well. And Professor Tong, and I share with your concerns, your worries, and also use some very strong words like gambling, radical, authoritarianism, and also talk about social engineering. But could we interpret it as these are just tactics or Xi Jinping's strategy, which is that you cannot open up China's political system immediately. So you may need to consolidate power, therefore, just like what Jiang Jingguo did early on. And this also raises a question about the society, because all the changes not only just led by leaders, but also by society. Early on, when Xi Jinping laid out the middle class, market reform, legal development, governments also reflect the social demand Now, you mentioned about young people in Hong Kong and Taiwan, but we should not forget young people in mainland China. They are also forced for change. Their mindset, their value, differ profoundly from their preceding generation, probably more similar to their peers in Hong Kong, in Taipei, in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Tokyo. So what is this implication? This make you to be optimistic or pessimistic based on this assessment? And for Scott, I have actually three quick questions. When you mentioned that Xi Jinping's leadership became less transparent, are you saying that Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin are quite transparent? This is number one. Second, you talk about DNA, not in their DNA. And is that true that Xi Jinping is surrounded by financial technocrats, world-class financial technocrats? They contribute, they play a very important role in any international institutions, in private banks like Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, IMF, and etc. Do you think they don't have DNA? What about Xi Jinping himself? He advanced his career from Fujian, Zhejiang, and Shanghai, which are market-friendly. He pushed for market reform. Is this not a factor we should consider? And finally, you talk about the 38 leading groups. Now, this raises a very interesting question. You know, in 2 years, there will be another party congress. Should we look at these leading groups, or should we look at the Power Bureau and the Standing Committee? And finally, and Professor Zeng, about the land reform, very, very important subject, but our knowledge is so limited. Thank you for sharing your observation. Now, this land reform is also interpreted as an urbanization process because people, rural area, will move from urban areas because of land reform. They can transfer or sell the lands. So how really the urban area is in terms of the environmental protection, in terms of public goods like water, traffic, and in terms of social tensions, is the in excess education and et cetera, all the benefits. And finally, in terms of jobs. So what's the best strategy in terms of timing? And should we be concerned about all these factors in urban area? And before we talk about the land reform and urbanization. So quickly to answer this first set of questions, then open the door for others.
Thank you, Professor Lu. I think these 四个全面 or 4 comprehensiveness is very important ideological innovation, quote unquote, under Xi Jinping. But it's very comprehensive. And also in terms of rule of law, what I really concern is that whether the rule of law could be implemented under the party state system. Under the party state system, how to develop kind of supervision mechanism. I think it's really the core of this kind of a rule of law discussion. Because as we all understand that the current situation tried to combine rule of law and some traditional culture, Confucianism. But it seems to me that it's a kind of very odd combination. For instance, the re-establishment of the social norms. Secondly, whether it's an elite center or law center. Thirdly, whether the rule of law will be used as an instrument to consolidate the party state control or return to the Western concept of rule of law. I think that is a major difference. The second about the improvement of the governance. Again, I'm just wondering that probably they are going to promote a new kind of a model called Gango entrepreneurship, government-organized non-governmental organizations. That will be the new instrument for them. Probably it's nothing very new, but they try to combine with the entrepreneurship, to combine with market forces under the different kind of state control. But they try to avoid direct intervention from the top. So that's why they have a kind of a new mechanism of governance. It doesn't mean that the retreat of the state. I will argue that that will be a indirect way for the state to re-intervene into social life.
Well, it's not a question that I could kind of quickly respond, but I would try. So I guess the second question is that we should sort of factor in the young people in this equation and in mainland China. And well, I mean, that's obviously right, but I guess that's exactly the point I'm trying to make during my talk, which is that, I mean, it's certainly true that, you know, those social challenges are simply the outcomes of after so many years of opening up to the outside world. And so the increasing a gap in a social in income inequality and other things, and you know, disparities across different sectors of the society, it obviously makes it extremely difficult for the central Chinese government to govern the entire country. And I guess that's exactly why Xi Jinping took such a radical, I mean, radical, that's a relatively speaking, compared to his predecessor, Hu Jintao. I mean, you got so many high-ranking cadres arrested and tried. I mean, that's obviously why I use this term, radical. And it's not, I mean, it doesn't mean that I'm very pessimistic about China's future, but just it's a long shot, I mean, right? So, and it's extremely radical because previously when we characterized China as a regime with collective leadership, it's basically a rule by consensus among those elites. But now, why it's radical is because what Xi Jinping is doing is trying to break that pact. So now, no power is going to be shared. I'm going to consolidate the power. I'm going to monopolize the power. And after he's done that, he moved on to the social cooptation. And so if he can do it, then obviously he would transform Chinese regime from a single party or, you know, bureaucratic military hegemony regime to a regime close to a personalist regime. And that's obviously going to change China fundamentally. And if he can, I mean, he can do that, then obviously, I mean, China would be, you will have another new China in you know, 5 to 10 years. And especially, he's so ambitious that it does not stop at the elite level restructuring. He also tried to, you know, co-opt new potential social opposition. And I mean, if he can do that, obviously China would be even stronger than it is today. But that's pretty risky, right? I mean, that's why I use gamble. I mean, if he fails, then you could, and especially, you know, talking about young people. I mean, most young people today, you know, I go to China pretty often, and you know, when I, you know, talk to young people there, I mean, you could sense that aspiration for Western style lifestyle, and they want to go to the U.S. or other Western countries for study, and they want to explore new way of life, and so obviously, what Xi Jinping is doing right now is totally, you know, diametrically opposed to that aspiration. And for now, I mean, we don't see any potential insurrections or, you know, initiated by young people. But in the long run, I guess that's another source of instability that, you know, Xi Jinping has to face if he's still empowered by then. Okay, thanks.
Terrific questions. I love always being pushed a little bit on these. In terms of transparency, I think what we've done is we've gone to a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is the most transparent. We've gone to from a 4 to about a 2, is what I would say. And I think the reason we were up at 4 is because the government bureaucracy had more policymaking authority, and they competed against each other. And so outsiders could engage different parts of that bureaucracy to learn about policy and collaborate with different parts of the bureaucracy, both at the national level and the local level. It's much harder to do that now, I think. Talking to companies and others that engage the system, that type of ability to divide and conquer isn't there anymore as the way it used to be. In terms of the DNA of these officials, I guess I'm not a geneticist, so I can't say for sure. But even with a very well-respected group of advisors around Xi Jinping and in the rest of the bureaucracy, the experience is that they are prone to incrementalism, even when it's in a liberal direction. Just about any type of liberalizing policy is always cut into 7, 8, 10 steps rather than in one foul swoop, and that may be because of DNA, it may be because of the situation they're in, where it just they're scared of the risks of totally liberalizing any one area at any one time. So whether it's situational or genetic, I guess we'll have to see. But it the behavior is still relatively similar. As for the decision-making process at the top, I would never say the Politburo Standing Committee is irrelevant, but I would say what is interesting with all these leading groups is that policymaking now is and there are now more leading groups than there are ministries. So policymaking is now organized by problem, not by general issue area. If you look at who sits on these leading groups and how they operate. And so, you know, I think the leading small group on comprehensively deepening reform is China's de facto cabinet right now, not the State Council. Even though I wouldn't say the State Council is irrelevant at all, but the way that organization operates, they don't just collect information and share general thoughts the way leading small groups used to act. It really seems to me their function has changed. This is something that Chris Johnson and I have been paying a lot of attention to lately, and we're working on something that ought to be out in the next couple weeks.
Okay, thank you for your question. I think land reform is part of the industrialization and urbanization process. Because of industrialization, it creates huge opportunities, job opportunities for migrant workers. And as to your question, whether the cities are ready or not, I don't think they are ready to give equal access to education and health services to migrant workers and to grant them urban household registration. But the problem is that today, if you go to China's countryside, you can hardly see young people around because all of them have left for cities. The preferred work in, you can call them the sweat workshop or the construction sites instead of tilling the land. So the question becomes, in 20 years' time, who will till the land? Who will grow food for Chinese population? And I think that's why rural land reform is so urgent today.
Well, thank you all for answering my questions, although some of the questions may be, you know, unfair and too harsh, and I just want to push you to think about all these different ways to be fair to anyone. And now it's open, and okay, since you already stand up, okay.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Donna Wells. I'm a mathematician. I make predictive math models. The ambassador mentioned a decline in exports from Taipei to mainland China. Can we talk about that? Is it entirely market-based, or is that by design? Thank you.
Could you, do you want a specific one?
No, the panel's fine. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, anyone? Okay. Who would like to answer that question?
I'll just briefly say this isn't my area of expertise, but in general, I think declining trade that China has had recently is simply a consequence of the slowdown of the economy writ large, which has affected all of its trade. I mean, this the dollar value of imports of oil, for example, have dropped dramatically, even though the quantity has stayed the same. So I'd imagine that it's the same for Taiwanese companies exporting to the mainland, facing the same types of pressures, which is why companies from everywhere, you know, are more dissatisfied and you know have problems with the mainland. It's to some extent it might be a tightening of things and some of the things that you mentioned in terms of industrial policies, but it's also just there's less business, and when there's less business, companies are more cranky.
Yes.
Greg Weehole from Radio Free Asia. I think I'm going to press the panel a little bit more, and I'm going to flip my position from a human rights activist to a supporter of the authoritarian regime. Since we saw the biggest drama of financial history in the last week, and is still ongoing, the Chinese stock market has sank from 30% to a 15% rebound, and we are talking about 1.2 trillion RMB trading volume every day, which is higher than the NYSE. this has never happened before in the, well, except the 1929 Wall Street meltdown. This is a unique experience. So my question to the panel would be, well, shall we rewrite the textbook of economy or political economy? Since China is always an exception, it can use its political force or security force and into the stock market and searching each listing company, which is American can't do. But we know that from the policy circle of the Chinese stock for those central bankers, they are all well-educated. They come from Yale. They are highly critical to the U.S. economy. They said, why American has killed Yi? Why not China? Now, if we compare the NYSE, the P/E ratio is around 23. Nowadays in China, is Shanghai stock market is P/E ratio is only 18, which is comparatively lower than the U.S. So my question would be, are you guys sticking to your textbook, or shall we rewrite the textbook because of China, since they can do the things that which we cannot imagine? If they can't, so my question would be, if they can't sustain the so-called Chinese model, when is the breaking point? If we missed the breaking point last week, when will be the next triggering point for the Chinese collapse? Thank you.
Well. Well, first, do you have an answer? Okay. So the answer is no, he does not have an answer. So do we have an answer?
Yeah. I'll give an answer. Whether I know if it's the answer, I can't say for sure. I mean, I think it's in general just not a good idea to be dogmatic or ideological about these type of issues. In general, that type of intervention that they displayed, both in the run-up of the market and in the run-down, are things not to be generally favored. We got to pay attention to the run-up in the market, which is since spring of 2014, a whole lot of stimulus package, step-by-step over time. That's just as dangerous as what they did over the last 10 days, having companies suspend their trading, creating a fund to buy the shares, ordering large shareholders not to sell off their shares, those type of things. Both violate the standard conventional wisdom of what one ought to do. I think the question is, both exist in a context. The anti-corruption campaign and maybe other factors generated slower growth than they were expecting, and they would needed to do something to stimulate the market. And it just so happened they also, a lot of that money moved into the securities sector instead of going into the real economy. They also allowed margin trading, which was a big reason why that happened. Now to get out of the problem then, you can understand why they would intervene with a 30% drop. In October 1987, the U.S. stock market, Dow Jones Industrial Average, dropped 23%. NASDAQ's bubble bursting, the dot-com bubble, that was a 78% drop in the market. 2008, Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 54%. So China's in there. That's not unprecedented. And in each of those instances, the U.S. and others and other stock markets have intervened in some way or another. This is a Chinese just much more dramatic, right? And of course, we pay much more attention to that. So the question is, going forward, will they create policies that will make it less likely that they need to intervene? Can they make the regulation better? Can they push? Can they get rid of margin trading? Less stimulus? I don't know. It's that balancing act. We always like to say that China comes to some intersection that's historic. That happens like every day. So I don't see that we're in any clear intersection now where it's going to be one direction or another. That's like watching Chinese economic reform is like waiting for Godot, that famous American play. Godot just never arrives. So I think we ought to be focusing on something different than that.
Yes, please.
Well, I'll just give you my take on the textbook issue. I mean, But the thing is, you're asking whether we should rewrite the textbook. But the thing is, I think there's no textbook to follow anyway to start with. When I wrote my dissertation on trade policy in China at Harvard, I mean, there is no model to follow. I mean, in terms of the, you know, the textbook of political economy models, I mean, simply we cannot find any models on the shelf off the shelf to study China. I mean, so I suppose for everyone who studied China, I mean, we are actually collectively writing a new textbook on China. And maybe that's one of the reasons why the Chinese leadership is so proud of their achievements, because they actually have no model to follow. And that's why this gradualist approach, or the groping the stone for to cross the river, becomes the motto of the Communist Party. And so in that sense, I guess, I mean, we are writing a new textbook. And collectively, I guess, we wait until 10 to 20 years to actually write a textbook for ourselves.
Well, crisis is not always a bad thing, you know, in general term, not in specific term, of course. And because it revealed some of the flaws in the Chinese stock market in the operation, the mismatch between, you know, firm performance and also the stock list, and the overconfidence about the government role, and many other problems. I can give you a long list. But when it occurred, and I think that it's a wake-up call for a nation, actually, over the past 20-some years, always want to learn lessons from the previous mistakes. So I hope this one will serve that function. Now, as in terms of government interference, I think that American Federalist once said, the bad governments are two kinds. One wants to do too much, one wants to do too little. I think we should find a balance when dealing with these financial regulations and et cetera. We will take probably one last question. And yes. Jake.
Jacques Delisle, University of Pennsylvania. If one were to have a panel like this 10, 15, 20 years ago on Chinese domestic developments and cross-strait issues, a lot of it would have been about possible convergence, right? The openness to political reform on the mainland, economic marketization, all of that. And of course, from Li Donghui through Ma Ying-jeou, we've heard a lot about how Taiwan might help change the mainland in some way. That conversation is wholly alien to this. And I wanted to put to the panel how much of an issue this is in terms of Taiwan's receptivity to mainland representations about cross-strait accommodations. Yeah, how much that receptivity is affected by a picture that is much more critical of the values that Taiwan pushes politically and that is apparently much more skeptical about the legal guarantees, which ultimately would have to be the basis for any settlement.
So my understanding, to my understanding, in terms of local governance, mainland China is trying to learn some experiences from the KMT rule in 1980s, even earlier, and try to avoid the mistakes, so-called mistakes, because the rise of civil society led to democratization. But the current Chinese thinking is that how to have a kind of social forces under the control of the state without striding into democratization. Or the other side of the coin is that how to consolidate the party state control under such a kind of pluralism. So I think that is, I'm not quite sure what that is the experiences of Taiwan, but in the long term, I think we have to trust about the social forces, the knowledge of the people, and also, as we discussed earlier, that generation change will have a major impact on the future development.
Well, if I may, that I also want to add, I think that the thesis of convergence is not completely gone. In my view, it is more so now than ever before. You look at Xi Jinping's four comprehensiveness, middle-class development, market economy, the rule of law, and the strong governments in terms of control official behaviors. These are all the things that the Taiwan went through 1970s and 80s. Earlier, there are two questions about the arrest of human rights lawyers. Actually, I do not see that as a pure negative news. I think, of course, that you know that Chen Shui-bian, Li Shou-lian, and many other lawyers, their lawyers, they were arrested and in their life, later became president, vice president, et cetera. So that kind of a pattern, I think, in certain ways, it's parallel in both, you know, both sides of Taiwan Strait. And of course, I'm not arguing that there will be entirely identical, no, because of the size, because of the historical circumstances, because of many other things can have profoundly impact. But I do see some of the similarities are more important than fundamental differences. But of course, China, and early on, we also many of the panelists talk about uncertainty. It's enter a period of uncertainty. But it will be problematic to see all the things are quite negative, or, you know, we become really pessimistic. I think Winston Churchill once said, the difference between, you know, optimist and a pessimist is pessimist sees calamity in every opportunity, and optimist sees opportunity in every calamity. So how you look at these things? I only wish that the Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders will be optimists, to learn lessons from the stock market crisis, to learn lessons from China's problems, flaws in terms of domestic and foreign policies. And so I think that my question is really about the pessimism and optimism when we look at China. So I will leave you to say a few words.
Well, I mean, just want to offer some contrarian view on the four comprehensives that you just mentioned. So, I mean, just look at these terms, you might think, well, there will be a convergence of governance, right? I mean, the middle class, market economy, rule of law, governance, or anti-corruption. These are all values that I guess pretty much universal, right? Every Western country would agree that these are important values. But the thing is, if you take a deeper look at these terms in the Chinese context, middle class, well, I mean, it's a backbone of democracy, or it's an important source of, you know, civic activism in Western society. But in China, there is not much space for civic activism, right? Just, you know, citing someone who said, I mean, the arrests of the lawyers. So, well, middle class, that's obviously not something people mean here. Market economy, also, it's not quite the same as the market economy people talk about here. I mean, the Communist Party still wants occupies the commanding heights of the economy, right? For the important, you know, sectors that, you know, like heavy, you know, capital intensive sectors, that they still want to have, you know, important influence in those sectors, and don't want to give those controls away. And rule of law, I mean, without an independent court, how could you talk about rule of law? And finally, anti-corruption, it's anti-corruption campaign against cadres, the Communist Party, right? And so it's a very China-specific institutional setting. So, I mean, in terms of the, I guess, on the face of it, we could all agree that these terms are, you know, symbols of modernity. But the thing is, I just kind of wonder how these terms should be correctly interpreted in the Chinese context. And I'm not saying that, well, China should just follow what Western countries or other, I don't know, developing countries or developed countries have gone through. I'm not saying that. I mean, China obviously, or mainland China obviously, should develop an entirely different kind of political culture or economic or social cultures. That's fine. I mean, I'm fine with that. But what I don't quite agree with was the confusion of, you know, different concepts when they should be interpreted in different ways to capture the real essence of those terms.
Well, it's quite fair, but still, I think that it's better to hear these terms rather than like a proletarian dictatorship, class struggle, and etc. These things really create a lot of Article 9.
Yeah,
you know, these things.
Touché.
And it's really a wonderful discussion, and the good thing is that we not necessarily agree. We disagree, but this certainly reinforces the importance of this critical moment in terms of China's domestic, economic, and political development, and its implication to the stability and peace of the Taiwan Strait and beyond. And I would like the audience to join me to thank you for our panelists for another wonderful, wonderful panel discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chung. Thanks to the panelists. We're now going to have a break. for about 15 minutes. There's caffeine out there, there's sugar out there, everything you need to wake up, and we'll reconvene at 3 o'clock.